This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
Hello. I'm Dr. Mark Owen from the Centre of Religion, Reconciliation and Peace, and I'm joined today by my colleague and friend, Professor Anna King. Welcome.
Hello, Anna. I'm Anna. I'm Professor of Religious Studies and Social Anthropology.
Okay, thanks, Anna. So we are doing this special short edition today of the Talking Peace, Exploring Conflict podcast in response to the developing situation in Myanmar. Anna and I have been working there for the past several years, and we'll say a bit more about that. We're going to do a more in-depth podcast on Myanmar over the next couple of weeks with some invited guests, but we thought it was perhaps useful, hopefully, and important to offer some brief commentary on the events as they unfold. Okay, so to offer some brief introduction to our history and work in Myanmar, Anna and myself have been going back and forth for around the last 5 years, supporting religious peace building in several different locations in Myanmar, predominantly in Kachin, and mainly in Magina and the surrounding areas, which is the capital of Kachin state. We've also been doing work in central Myanmar and also in Rakhine, where, of course, the Rohingya issue has become hugely prominent over the last few years. The projects we've been supporting are mainly faith-based community peace-building work, training local faith actors in things like conflict analysis, dialogue facilitation, some social economic projects which bring together faith actors around common social economic initiatives. So we've been doing some project development support, some training, and also project evaluation. Our main partner in Myanmar has been the faith-based organisation Religions for Peace Myanmar, part of the Religions for Peace Global Network. They have also started a national dialogue through an advisory forum, which has been participated in by the NLD government, by the military, and also by a range of other civil society actors. Religions for Peace has done a lot of work around building and supporting women, faith-based actors, and also youth. And in fact, their women's projects have been hugely successful, offered an amazing, quite inspirational avenue to bring women of different faith together across common purposes. And in fact, I would want to argue, given our project evaluation, really the women's networks and building of those relationships and networks across religions has probably been one of the most successful aspects of the Religions for Peace work that we've seen and supported. Hand over to Anna there, who's going to give us some updates on recent events, histories, and some responses to the military coup. Anna, please.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mark. The question is whether the army has signed its death warrant or not. The coup was justified by the army in the name of democracy. The army claims that the constitution allows it to take power in situations that threaten national security or sovereignty. In this case, it claimed that allegations of electoral fraud needed to be investigated. These claims seem to have very little substance. In the November elections, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, had a sweeping victory over the military proxy party. The Union Solidarity and Development Party, or for short, the USDP. Actually, however, the elections brought to a head long-standing tensions between the civil government and the military. And although the generals had initiated reforms themselves after the national elections in the late 2010, they retained much of their power and prerogatives. So that, for example, the constitution guaranteed military control of three powerful ministries, a quarter of the seats in parliament, and a veto over constitutional changes. There was therefore an unresolved power struggle between the NLD and the military. And Myanmar's leaders, as Mark has suggested, are still grappling with the consequences of British colonial rule, 6 decades of civil war, and military dictatorships. So there are also long-standing ethnic, religious divides, most tragically expressed in the brutal assault on the Rohingya Muslims. The NLD, after its victory in 2015, proposed constitutional reforms that would have limited the special powers and privileges of the army. In the 2020 November elections, the NLD won 87% of the parliamentary seats, and the military-backed USDP a mere 7%. Many senior members of the USDP were former military commanders who lost their seats, and regions formerly loyal to the military went over to Aung San Suu Kyi's party. So the military faced losing political and economic power. So the coup, and what's been the response to that? Well, there's been overwhelming international condemnation. For President Joe Biden, the military assault on democracy presents a problem, and he's already threatened sanctions. However, China and many members of the Association of Southeast Asia Nations claim that it is an internal matter. Western sanctions against the military leaders are very unlikely to persuade them to change course. Myanmar now has many problems: economic downturn after COVID-19, widespread poverty and conflicts, including dozens of armed groups. However, Aung San Suu Kyi has called for non-violent protest, and so far public response has been very peaceful. Many religious leaders like Cardinal Bo, the Archbishop of Yangon, have spoken out against the coup. Many people have demonstrated quietly. Doctors and nurses have stopped work. Others in Yangon banned saucepans and kettles. There's been protest on social media despite blocked access to Facebook and restricted access to the internet. For ethnic minorities like the Kachin, Karen and Shan, there is fear that violence will intensify. And certainly for the Rohingya, the outlook seems very bleak. The prospect of their return to their homes seems very far away. And Christians and Muslims on the internet and on websites have expressed great fear of the increase in military power. So at the moment, the response to the coup has been, as Aung San Suu Kyi asked for, peaceful but powerful. And I'm now going to hand you over to Mark, who's going to talk about some of the steps that could be taken from a religious peace-building perspective.
Excellent, Anna, and thank you very much for that. And before we do that, can I just ask, we've been discussing, haven't we, that the international response, and you mentioned there something about the potential consequences or effect of that. What can I ask you, what do you make of the international response, and broadly speaking, do you think the tone is about right?
Well, I think the international response is, it's been quite strong, but I think it's difficult to know that it will have any effect at this stage. I mean, the UN has protested, but it's, America is looking towards China. Internally, I mean, there's been very quiet protest. The European Union has made some, presented a view which is outraged at what has happened. I don't know, my own feeling is, and I hope this is true, that the military have lost a lot of popular support. And in fact, it may be their death throes politically. I mean, I hope that's true. I hope that, you know, popular protest will mean that they cannot carry on and enhance their power. But I may be totally wrong over that. But that's what I pray for and hope.
Yeah, now, of course, I think this, and we talked the last couple of days over this, haven't we, about this international response is really interesting, because I agree, the tone's been quite harsh. I just want to read you a few words from Cardinal Charles Bo, who we have known from our work in Myanmar. He's the Archbishop of Yangon, President of Catholic Bishops, President of the Catholic Bishops Conference of Myanmar, President of the Federation of Asian Bishops, and a patron of Religions of Peace International. And I just found his words fascinating. He released a statement last night, and it was actually part of that statement directed specifically at the international community. And it says, and I quote, "We are grateful for your concern and appreciation, and appreciate your sense of shock. We are grateful for your compassionate accompaniment at this moment. It matters a lot. But history has painfully shown that abrupt conclusions and judgments ultimately do not benefit our people. Sanctions and condemnations brought few results. Rather, they've closed doors and shut out dialogue. These hard measures have proved a great blessing to those superpowers who eye our resources." I presume he's talking about China there. "We beg you, do not use force. You do not force concerned people into bartering our sovereignty. The international community needs to deal with the reality, understanding well Myanmar's history and political economy. Sanctions risk collapsing the economy, throwing millions into poverty." Unquote. And I just thought that was a fascinating, quite nuanced response compared to some of the other international statements about sanctions, condemnation. And this is someone who actually obviously lives in Myanmar, knows the history and lived reality well, is himself from a minority religious group, is actually saying to the international community, please don't be too harsh, please don't condemn what's happened, try and understand, and don't close the doors to dialogue by criticising the military openly. And I just wondered what you thought about that approach.
I think he's absolutely right. I do think he's right. I think sanctions would actually hurt the people of Myanmar. And what's more, what I do think is that I think that Myanmar is a very different country than it was, say, two decades ago. For example, its online presence, people contact each other, they discuss political events much more than they did. It's much more integrated society. And I think the fact that the recent elections in November showed such a popular swing towards Aung San Suu Kyi's party, I just think that it's absolutely right that a lot of thunder and judgment, and it really won't do any good at all. And I do agree that dialogue, negotiation, peace building, hopefully the military will be forced eventually to withdraw. I do believe that the Burmese are really much more alert to political violence than they were. I really do. And I think even the attitudes to ethnic minorities, to the Rohingya, a lot of people will not agree with me, but I think they may be gradually changing, as we saw in our work. And hopefully those armed conflict, those militias, that they will be replaced by safe places in which negotiation can take place.
Yeah, no, thank you. And also, I've been speaking to a couple of people in Myanmar today, as I know you have been, and really it's a sense of confusion. That's what I'm understanding. For the average person, certainly in Yangon, the people I spoke to, not a huge amount has actually changed. There's a lot of confusion, a lot of fear. Yeah. And certainly it's going to take a huge amount of bravery to stand up to the military, because we know that they can be extremely excessive in using force, and they have done in the past against protesters. Mm-hmm. But I think people have a much greater, as you said, awareness, sense of determination. They've had a few years now where they've been able to be in contact with the outside world, have become much more aware of the international community, much more learned about democratic processes, rights, etc. And I think from the people I'm speaking to, there's a real sense that people are not prepared to put up with this, and they won't back down. And to some extent, they're determined, as you say, through peaceful process, but to stand up to the military this time.
I think so. I mean, I agree with you that to actually go out on the streets and to protest, I think there is a lot of fear of that. People have been going out shopping and stocking up with food. I think we ought to mention COVID-19 here, that, you know, this comes on top of people who are often having to distance and account for that, get medicines. Yes, I know it, people are very, very confused, but I think the push towards democracy and towards greater justice between the regions, I think there is more of that. And there has been time for military rule. You know, the privileges that the military have enjoyed, even in the last decade, people see that they're outdated now, I think, and that they shouldn't have this very, very strong political role and privileges that they have been up to now.
Yeah. And what are you thinking about the role of faith-based actors, organisations? We know from our time there that really, I wouldn't say there's been a proliferation of civil society, faith-based actors, organisations involved in peace building. I would add a note of caution to that, that as we know from our own experiences, that the military has still kept a very close eye on that. It's not completely open by any means, and organisations can have their permission revoked if they do the wrong things. But there definitely is a burgeoning civil society now, and a very strong dimension of faith-based peace building and actors. And do you think they have developed to the extent where they can have an impact on resisting the military and the imposition of military rule again?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, I think that this is quite a passion of mine, actually, that multi-religious peace building, it can create safe places. It can mean that, for example, ethnic minorities feel, or even women feel, safer to get together for humanitarian or civic causes. And it also means that national leaders are far more in touch with regional and local actors. So that sense of, I do think that between different groups, different ethnic and religious groups, there's often fear. Even the majority, for example, the majority Buddhist community, it can be fearful that its own identity is going to be reduced, and it can be very defensive and protective. But bringing communities together in action that benefits the entire community, I think does enable people to recognize that the other people are not enemies, they're not alien, they're not trying to undermine their status. And I do think religion, while it can inspire violence, it can also move towards creating greater harmony, peace, justice, equality, all these values and qualities that we so need in creating a sustainable and just society. So yes, I am optimistic about that as part of a general peace building process, not, you know, as one section.
Yeah, of course. Well, thanks very much, Anna. We're going to bring it to a close there now, I think, and really see what happens over the next few days. I mean, one of the things we'd like to do is speak to some people on the ground in Myanmar and some of our contacts. We don't know whether that's going to be possible, and evidently if it put them at any risk, then we're not going to do that. But we're going to talk and maybe come back with another podcast on the situation, and also bring in some people who've got other different insights and expertise to ourselves. So yes, thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again on this subject soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.